This is No Dogma Podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this evening I'm joined by Alec Lazarescu, the CTO of LearnBop, a company based in Manhattan, New York. Thanks for joining me, Alec.
Thank you for having me on.
Alec, can you tell me a little bit about yourself and what you do, please?
Sure. So I've spent almost all my career in the education domain, but I've been in quite a number of different roles. I started at a really small software company, being a developer and kind of a vendor for big software publishing giants, and eventually ended up at one of those giants at a 30,000 plus company. And now I'm CTO of LearnBop, so I've kind of come full circle again.
And what LearnBop is, it's a small startup in the educational space?
Yeah, so we're located in Manhattan. And what we've done is we've created an experience that we try to mimic that one-on-one tutor experience that really helps students learn the most. And we break down problems step by step. So if a student gets something wrong, we are able to analyze and see if they missed a prerequisite or have some sort of gap in understanding and lead them through that. And then we also make all that information available to their teachers so the teachers know right away where people are struggling and they can also give further assistance if needed.
This is as a supplement to full-time schooling, is that right?
Yeah, so it's not a full curriculum at this point. It's a tutorial supplement. So we help teachers do targeted tutoring in any areas they need. And we're mapped to Common Core as well as state standards so they can follow along with their curriculum any place their students need help.
Let's just take an example. Let's say a mathematics teacher is going over calculus or something. Where does LearnBop fit in?
So the teacher could decide after teaching a lesson to go to LearnBop and give students a warm-up assessment. And that would go through the concepts that the student would need to know. And if there was anything that they missed, perhaps in a previous grade or they've forgotten over the summer, that could be flagged. And that could also be remediated right in LearnBop. So instead of the teacher having to go through and kind of take the whole class's time going through a number of concepts that only a few students need, they'd be able to give those students the attention that they need through LearnBop, and then keep the class moving and going along and make sure they finish the material they need to cover.
Is this something that takes place during that same class time or something that the student would do after hours on their own?
It could be used either way. Most people seem to use it during class time. They pick maybe once a week part of a class period to use it with their class. But they can also assign work for students to do outside of class.
We met, I think, maybe about a month and a half ago at an event in New York, and this is what we're going to primarily talk about. You were giving a presentation on DevOps, and we're going to go through a few different parts of DevOps. But one of the things, I've interviewed a few people about DevOps, and the definition of DevOps seems to be very hard to nail down. How would you define DevOps?
So I actually really like the definition from John Willis. It's kind of the acronym CAMS. So it's culture, automation, measurement, and sharing. And it's really important to not forget about the order of that and the importance of each piece. You can't just do automation. The culture is a really critical part. You have to have good understanding and work relationships between people in different groups, or you'll never actually get to having a smoothly functioning system.
Is this something... sorry, how to put it? I've come across people who are doing DevOps, and the same John Willis hasn't come up in the past. Is he viewed as a fodder of this, or is he just someone who happened to be involved at an early stage?
So he wasn't one of like the kind of very, very first people, but he's definitely involved pretty soon into the DevOps movement, and he's given some really great presentations on it. He's a big fan of Deming. And he's kind of taken these very kind of philosophical routes to understanding how teams work together and how to do improvements and lean and how that applies to DevOps. So there's a few on YouTube that are definitely worth checking out.
Let's say a company has a dev team that's not performing the way they expect, how would you go about introducing DevOps into an organization like that?
So I think it kind of depends on how that team is working initially and how the company is structured. There's a lot of different reasons for a team to not be performing. One of the classic ones where people tend to go towards DevOps is when you have kind of that wall where one team does the development and then they don't deal with production, they don't deal with deployment, they just kind of throw it over the wall to some other team. And that works in some ways if you're not doing a lot of releases, but it makes all those releases you actually do very high stress, because now you're probably doing them a lot less often. You've changed a lot more things in the meantime. And if something goes wrong, there's a whole lot to sift through to figure out which of the many changes caused something to go wrong. So it's really not a way that people like to do software, that want to move quickly and kind of do some more modern software development. It's somewhat like waterfall deployment. There's a waterfall development, and that kind of gave way to agile, but I kind of think of this as waterfall deployment. So this is kind of a classic area where I think people reach towards DevOps, and there's a few ways to implement it, and I could get into kind of some right and wrong ways I've seen that maybe may not have the best benefit.
Well, yeah, maybe one or two examples of each, if you don't mind.
Okay. So there's kind of like the lone consultant where you hire someone who's supposedly going to change your organization and make DevOps happen there. And they come into your office and the teams kind of look at them with a bit of suspicion because they're just a consultant, or they don't know the business context. They don't know the code or the history. And often the teams don't really even give them that much of a chance because they haven't been given time to work with this person, most likely. They're just trying to fight their fires and get things done. So it's very rare that that one person actually makes the transformation happen. And I've seen it where it's not a consultant, it's a full-time hire, but it's still one person. And again, the team doesn't have time to deal with them. And then there's kind of like the rebranded DevOps team where people that may have had day jobs as sysadmins or just working as release engineers, they're called the DevOps team, but they still do their day jobs. They don't really have a focus on DevOps. No one has time to work with them. And the closest, I think, is the purpose-built DevOps team, which is still not quite there, but at least you have the focus on that side where they're not just doing the same old and given a new title. They've actually had some experience with it, whether internally or brought from the outside. And then they're more likely to be able to affect change. But again, you might run into a wall where the dev team hasn't had time assigned to really work with them. And the other part is that chances are the dev team was working with an IT team or some other way to do deployments. So now you kind of have like a third person in the mix. And you basically made another silo, which is another concern to be aware of.
In your work in this field, are these problems unique to software? Because I've only worked in software, but I get the feeling that the software industry seems to have problems that other industries don't have, either through complexity or lack of maturity, or maybe just constant change. I don't know what it is. Do you have any insight into that?
I think it's part of it because the possibilities are almost infinite. You can't really get around physics if you're building something in the real world. You can model the physics, you can try things out, and you know outright if something's never going to work and it's going to fail. Whereas software, you take almost an opposite approach. You just like to try things out rapidly. You want to learn, and almost anything is possible given enough time or the right technique towards it. So it's definitely a very different approach. And the cost for failure in most software is very low, excluding medical devices and other areas like that, where that's kind of much closer to physical engineering in terms of rigor or launching a space probe. But that makes a huge difference, the fact that it's not something that is a life or death situation, and you can move faster if you take the time and make a few mistakes and learn along the way versus trying to plan it all out in your head ahead of time.
A moment ago, when you were talking about introducing DevOps, You mentioned change, and I've had interviews with other people where change seems to be one of the biggest problems that companies, large and small, and people face. If a practitioner of DevOps is coming in, or a company is going to introduce a DevOps team, how do they get people to accept the change that's inevitable?
So I think it's best to start and understand how the company got that way, whatever structure it has now, and how the processes came into place. Because you don't want to assume that they just came up with something on a lark. There must have been some reasons for it. And a lot of people talk about Conway's Law, where an organization, the way it develops systems is very closely linked to how it's physically structured, how the teams are set up, what the organizational chart is like. So what I'd like to do is talk with people in those teams and see what goals they have. If you have an IT team, if you have a security team, what goals do they have and what processes have they put in place to meet those type of goals? And from there, you can take a step back and see, if we were to rearrange the way the organization is set up, and rather than kind of the physical view that an org chart gives you, go for some more of a virtual logical structure, can you do things differently? Is there a way to help people meet their goals still in the same or better method than they're doing now, and also help some other aspects of the organization as well? So I think that's a powerful way to start, not just to enforce change on people or tell them they're going to lose or miss out on something, but find a way to not just get whatever your team's goals are, but also their goals as well.
But it sounds like you've expanded the scope now way beyond the development team to the organization, to the hierarchy, to the structure.
Absolutely. And DevOps is not an all-inclusive term as written. I've seen people call it kind of star ops because security is involved, QA is involved, product owners are involved. Everyone has a role to play in delivering products and understanding the business context and making decisions. And certainly management is involved. I mentioned a lot of those ways to get to DevOps that don't quite work. Most of them are failures of allocating time for people. And it's not enough if even some senior executives are convinced that DevOps is the way to go. If every person's boss all the way down the line is not making time for these initiatives, time for people to collaborate, work together, understand the system, they're not going to succeed. It's very hard to work long term on something that is not your main focus and you're constantly pulled to firefight and do your day job. Like, DevOps should be part of your day job. You should have some time set aside for these continuous improvement and collaboration projects.
Another person I interviewed, Igor Muchnik, he's a big DevOps character. And he was saying that in his company, Constant Contact, their DevOps team pretty much evangelizes. They don't do the work for the dev teams. They'll go in, they'll tell them how to do it, they'll train them, maybe they'll work with them once, and then they let them off to do it themselves. Is that an approach you'd advocate as well?
I think that's actually a very good approach. I advocate something very close to that. I call them facilitators. So it's just a half step past evangelists, where I would also say they, in addition to helping people understand the value and helping them out with maybe kickstarting it, they also help serve to communicate good practices across the different groups on what's worked well from other teams, maybe even set up some reference models on this is a great way that we've done automation and deployment for this set of technology. And if you have a very specific reason that you want to do something else, maybe that's fine and you can go ahead. But if you're fine just going along with this and you don't have a good reason to diverge, you may as well save yourself the time and make use of the same thing.
We've talked quite a bit about the development side of DevOps. Can you tell me maybe how DevOps affects the operations side of your company?
Actually, a company with those specific roles going to different people, there's still a lot of value that comes from a culture of collaboration that DevOps promotes. Developers know best where the skeletons in the code are, and those are the places that could really benefit from additional logging or monitoring. Operations can in turn provide guidance on typical scale issues and failure modes to guard against, or really at a minimum add some targeted monitoring for. They can also inform about useful tools and scalable monitoring best practices. So both sides bring a lot to the table by working together.
During your presentation back in December, you were suggesting that introducing microservices can be very helpful in a move towards DevOps.
So it can be helpful because it does give you that decentralized view and give teams ownership of end-to-end. So rather than a matrix organization where there's a lot of handoffs and different groups doing things for your app or managing production, in a microservice architecture, generally it goes along with having that team ownership of the whole chain. But if it's just pure microservices and you don't have that facilitation and cross-team sharing, you might spend a lot of time reinventing the wheel. You could build a lot of redundant things. And there might be variations, whether intentional or not. There's some services that may not have the best SLAs or uptime or rigor. And that might be okay because they're new, or it might not be okay. It might just be problematic. And there could be human single points of failure if not enough people understand the technology setup within that stack, and the one or two key people aren't available. It's going to be very problematic to troubleshoot or work on things. So there's definitely value in taking some time to do some sort of knowledge sharing, and not just saying anyone can just kind of stand up anything they like. You can build a form of technical debt by having way too many microservices and not sort of taking the time to reconcile or come up with some good practices to refactor towards.
And would you view that sort of keeping control of what's being built part of DevOps or just part of general software engineering?
I see it as part of kind of enterprise architecture. If you're a big company, that seems to be sort of that governance and reference model approach that when done right is very helpful there. But certainly could be part of DevOps as well. It's really a matter of how you structure a company and what you call people. Either way can work as long as someone's paying attention to cross teams, what's going on.
So I can imagine, you know, if you come into a small development team and you introduce something like this, take the example just with microservices, everyone might be in the same room or in the same building anyway. What starts to happen with a much larger organization, maybe spread out across time zones, office in Europe, office in the US, office in Asia? How do you deal with those kind of scenarios?
What tends to happen is you start having a breakdown in alignment because you're not in the same room. You may be working on different products. You may have different business goals or different timetables. And now there start to be disagreements, and it could be harder to really start getting things done. So it can be troublesome if you're trying to do technology and you don't have that alignment. So if you at least have some sort of shared common base or some models that have been shown to work, it could be helpful and not sort of diverge in that manner.
Would you, though, if for example, you had three offices and three geographic and time zone separations, would you advocate three DevOps setups or run DevOps out of the head office?
So I think of DevOps as a virtual team, and you have members that are part of this virtual team on your other teams. So one way you could look at it is you have the core members, which are kind of the facilitators slash evangelists we talked about before. And then you have kind of satellite members, which are people on various teams that are doing their day job for delivery on whatever products that they're working on in whatever capacity. You will have QA members, you'd have members that are developers. And by having that sort of virtual DevOps team, you have some communication constantly across those groups, kind of working towards the best way you can figure to work together to deploy. And it doesn't become kind of the DevOps team silo in one country just telling the other teams what to do, because that can start getting problematic, and it gets into kind of a command and control and finger pointing situation if you don't establish a cross team ownership of DevOps.
During your presentation in New York, you mentioned a gentleman named Simon Wardley. I'm having trouble pronouncing that, and his impact on this field.
Yeah, and he was actually an early cloud pioneer and pioneer of platform as a service, and he came up with a really great diagram that could help explain the value of different roles in the life cycle of a project in an organization. All of this is on his blog, and they're pretty data dense, so it's definitely worth taking a look at later on. And it's Creative Commons licensed, so you can actually present these diagrams and use them as well. So the pioneers are kind of the trailblazers, and they're comfortable going in where there's nothing there, no safety nets. They can start building that platform, and they're comfortable with uncertainty. They can go ahead and learn from failure, even if there's some missteps along the way, and get you up and running. Once you have a service that's been running for a little bit, you kind of need the settlers to come in and they build on what the pioneers have started. So they're not necessarily comfortable dealing with total uncertainty and chaos like a pioneer, but they are comfortable kind of walking into a construction zone, and they see the potential for improvement, and they can transform some of the ad hoc beginnings into something more manageable and understandable. So they get things more structured, and you can actually, once you have things structured, you can start learning from feedback and become a little bit more data-driven and learning from the market. And if you keep succeeding, then it's the time for the town planners, and they build on what the settlers have started. And this is all about commoditization and making things turnkey, driving down cost per user, very metrics-driven, and just operationalizing everything and focusing on things like business continuity.
Do you see these as distinct teams of developers within a company or distinct roles those teams take on as a product matures?
So just take an example. There's more than three roles, but let's just have dev, QA, and sysadmins as roles. And then we have pioneers, settlers, and town planners. So every combination, you'd get a total of nine. And it's sometimes people are thinking, well, aren't sysadmins kind of more risk averse, perhaps, if they're in operations? Like, why would they have a pioneer? But nonetheless, someone needs to start investigating new technology and new frameworks, new ways to automate. So there's definitely a role for each of those nine possible combinations. So what you'd be able to do is if you have a very early product, let's say you're a startup and you're not even sure you have a market fit yet, you'd have mostly pioneers. So you'd have perhaps those three different roles just as a pioneer, and that would be your team. And after you see some success, get some paying customers, you want to add some settlers because now you have the risk of customer loss or risk of not meeting an SLA or some contract you signed. So you need to move past that. And then as you keep growing and you have bigger deals, bigger contracts, you become more mission critical, you have millions of users, then you add people from the town planner side for each of those roles. So by that time, you've kind of gone through that whole spectrum. And the other thing the town planners do is once they become established, they help build components that are reusable and generic. So let's say a centralized logging framework. And then if you do another product within that same company, you'd have pioneers, again, starting that product off, but they could make use of some of those reusable components. So they're not starting totally from scratch, but they're not really being kept from innovation either. A logging framework, unless you're a company that's your business, that's not an area of innovation. You're going to pioneer and work on something that provides a more direct value than that.
You mentioned there, though, that you add settlers to your pioneers and then you add town planners. But do you see that the same people being involved all the way through, but just being supplemented as something matures?
It depends. I think there's some rare cases where the same people could be involved the whole time. The same people may change roles, or people may still be needed for just providing some insight in a place where they haven't been fully operationalized and it's still kind of the newest area of the site. But you will have less pioneers most likely by the time you're bringing in your town planners. So the amount of people in each role will probably definitely change. And it's likely going to be different people. It's not to say the same person, can't kind of move through the roles themselves. But chances are it is different people. And it's also the company life cycle itself. You may be a pioneer on one project and a settler on a different one. So it kind of varies on what the needs are for that product and whatever it is in its life cycle.
That's one of the models that are out there. And then there's another one that you mentioned that Spotify has. I think it's tribes, squads, and chapters and other such.
Yeah, so that was a pretty famous paper in 2012. And it was Spotify's attempt to explain how they were going about scaling to a very large development team without going to the classic matrixed organization and a bunch of silos. So you can think of a squad as a, it's also called a pod by other people, as a unit of delivery, as far as a team, everything that's needed, including a product owner, dev, QA, systems engineering. So they're responsible end-to-end for whatever that product feature area is. Then they add the notion of chapters. So chapters go across squads within the same role. So let's say you have a chapter for QA, and they can share their good practices on how to work on automation, any patterns they use. They may work on page objects and tell another group that this is the way to go. And then you have the notion of guilds. And this is the part where I think it's really bringing it all together, where it's the notion of how do you build a group of people across different teams, across different roles that have a shared goal. So I see DevOps as kind of the automation and deployment guild. And you have a mix of people across pioneers, town settlers, and planners, and all your roles. I mentioned three dev, QA, and sysadmins, but you also have product owners providing some subject matter expertise. And that guild is kind of your virtual DevOps team that I was mentioning before. So I think the notions of pioneer settlers and town planners from Simon Wardley and the Spotify notion of guilds goes together to form a way you can think of how your DevOps team could work.
During your presentation, I remember thinking this, but and I didn't get a chance to ask at the time, why are all these names being bandied about, guilds and pioneers and town planners, when we have an industry that has names already, like engineer or senior engineer or so and so on?
Right. I think part of the problem with our industry is every name is very overloaded. Things get hyped up and it's hard to actually agree on what a particular role does. And it's almost becomes difficult to talk about at that point. Whereas if you take a step back and have a metaphor, it's easier to kind of just focus on responsibilities and not get caught up on the semantics of the role. And also throughout history, I think a lot of these ways of structuring aren't new. It's just a new context. Over time, there's a few different ways societies run, and we tend to run businesses and military and other things in very similar core ways on how people work together. It's just people come up with a new context, like a software company, and all of a sudden it's like an innovation, but it's really not some way of working that people haven't done before in some other context, probably since ancient times.
And would you advocate a company, if they're going to move to DevOps, to adopt something like the town planner approach or the guild approach?
I think it's good to consider that as far as a way to map skills and the importance of roles, along with the maturity level and needs of the product. I wouldn't necessarily say you give someone a pioneer in their job title or anything silly like that. I think it's a useful diagram and a way to organize, and I wouldn't go too far with it past that.
Okay, but let's say they have done that. They've decided to go with the guilds and all the associated. What happens after that? The company's making decisions. Where do they go from there?
So at that point, you have to start going back and reimagining what your processes are. So you've got this new virtual team, but you're probably doing things a different way before. So what would you do differently now that you have a new organizational structure that maybe before you had a goal that you were meeting within your team one way? Now perhaps with automation, there's a different way you can meet it. Security is a good example. where often there's the initial response from security teams might be to bristle a bit at the idea of developers dealing with production or DevOps in general. And there's actually a good website, devsecops.org, that talks about ways that DevOps, the idea of DevOps, is very compatible with security and can actually make things more secure. Because imagine with automation now, you're not just kind of relying on someone manually checking things or denying permissions. You can have continuous auditing, continuous compliance monitoring, and know when things aren't as they should be.
After a company's decided to go down this route, what kind of support's needed from, let's say, within the development organization and from management to achieve the goal?
Yeah, and that's actually really important to talk about both sides, because it won't work with just one side. If you have management trying to push down goals without getting some grassroots support, it can be challenging. And vice versa, if there's no management support for initiatives, there won't be time and budget. So on a management side, it's important to go ahead and do something like a SWAG, scientific wild-ass guess, where they just look at what sort of time is wasted now in things like deployment issues, environment issues, and everything can be very rough order of magnitude, just number of hours by some rough salary proxy, and that could kind of be your proxy for a budget for what are you losing without having a better system for doing deployments of software. And then they should also work on finding some champions within the groups themselves, whether in development or QA or product, that would be interested in trying this new way of working. And then from there, they could go ahead and take their budget estimates, also take some of the time they spent talking with other groups and seeing how other groups can meet their goals with DevOps as well, not just sort of what their own little group can get out of it. And the most important thing is to get time and budget allocated for every person that's needed. And that's not just development and system engineers, that's QA, because QA understands when the site is actually working properly. And unless you understand that, you're not going to be successful at automating and making sure you did it right. And product management as well, because the product owners understand what the business context is. And for certain products, they may be the subject matter experts of the customer expectations. They could know more than some of the devs in some cases, especially if it's a long-standing product and a lot of devs have kind of moved on to other things and you have some newer devs. So you want to get time allocated for everyone to make this a successful effort. And you want to make it real. You want to have milestones. You want to have goals for these improvements. You don't want to just rely on good things happening. You want to keep people on task for actually getting these things done.
Any final notes about this before we wrap up tonight, Ike?
I think that's probably a lot of info and a few things for people to dig into more, especially the Simon Wardley diagrams and the Spotify paper. They go into a lot more detail, and it'll make things a lot clearer to kind of see those firsthand. And just a note on LearnBop, we're actually right now developing a product for parents to use with their children so they can work on tutoring at home, whether their school has LearnBop or not. This is going to be a more automated product, so LearnBop will be able to determine where their kids are having trouble or they need more assistance and help students get through that. So we're going to be launching that in May, and we're very excited about that.
Very good. I'll put the links to the various websites we mentioned, Worldly, the Pioneers, Spotify, and a few more on the post with the podcast. Mm-hmm. But thank you very much for your time tonight, Alec.
The opening music was The Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was A Song She Heard by Raffae from the album Vesper.